Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al Fayed, Predator at Harrods.
Cash, with that you can control people.
Nothing comes for free.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London. I'm Julian Warwicker. It's been a day of ceremonies in Israel in memory of the nearly 1,200 people killed and 250 taken hostage by Hamas in the attacks launched from Gaza exactly a year ago. Earlier today, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu visited a monument for victims of the attack in Jerusalem. He said the Israeli people would not rest until the hostages were brought back.
On this day, in this place, and in many places in our country, we remember our dead, our hostages, whom we are obligated to bring back, and our heroes, who fell in defence of the homeland and the country. We went through a terrible massacre a year ago, and we stood up as a people like a lion.
A year ago, Israel stated its determination to destroy Hamas and release the hostages. But around 100 people are still being held. It's not known how many are alive. And Hamas, designated as a terror organisation by many Western governments, has, even in the last few hours, shown it can still fire rockets into Israel. The wider impact on the region since October the 7th last year has been huge. Israel's assault on Gaza has led to more than 41,000 deaths, according to the Hamas-run health ministry. In addition to that, thousands of homes have been destroyed and nearly 2 million people, the vast majority of the population, have been displaced. And in the north, Hezbollah rocket fire into Israel has in recent weeks met with a devastating military response. Airstrikes on what the Israelis say are Hezbollah targets have left more than 2,000 people in Lebanon dead. Well, here are some of the sounds from this day last year.
The army arrived, they went around, they killed all the terrorists that they could find at the time. They killed 7 terrorists. My son-in-law killed another 2 when they tried to infiltrate his house where my 3 grandchildren were. So he was protecting their lives with his body. As they cleared each section of the kibbutz, they started evacuating house by house, walking us to a central place on the kibbutz quickly, but walking so that we would be all in one place and it would be easier to protect.
Israel says it is at war with Palestinian militants who've launched the biggest attack on its territory in years.
This has been Israel's nightmare scenario, armed Palestinian militants at large in the south of the country. It's believed that dozens entered, some cutting through the perimeter fence from Gaza, others entering by sea.
We heard a shooting and then we started to run. And I ran into the woods. It was like a small forest. It was in front of the party. I didn't really know what to do, and I remember that I need to hide. After a few minutes, the terrorist was up me, and I hear them. I hear people screaming. I don't know if they catch them. I don't know what's really going on because I couldn't look because I was hiding. They talk in English, and they say, "Who's there? Get out and take your hands up." But I didn't go out because I was so scared. But there was 3 children next to me that go out, and then they shot them, one after one after one, and they fell down.
Well, our correspondent in Jerusalem is John Donison. He began by telling me about the events marking the day.
Well, obviously a hugely important and moving day for Israelis. 1 year ago, Israel's national trauma, I suppose, began. Its powerful military suffering its worst ever defeat to, or certainly humiliation, to a far inferior force. And today the country marked that moment and the loss of life. So this morning we had President Herzog join a ceremony at the site of the Nova Music Festival, where 364 partygoers were killed by Hamas gunmen. Really moving scenes there, actually. They had a minute silence, which was actually broken by just the sounds of wailing, and a kind of agonized screams went out. We had prayers there, and many of the families of those who died were there, and also some of those whose hostages, family members were taken hostage and, you know, still being held in Gaza. So, you know, it's been a big day here in Israel, but of course there are nearly 42,000 people who've died in Gaza over the past year, been killed in Gaza, and they are not going to have any sort of anniversary. And that figure coming from the Hamas Ministry of Health in Gaza, but those figures are kind of thought to be reliable by the UN.
And both in Gaza and on the Israeli-Lebanese border, the fighting has continued.
Absolutely. As that ceremony was going on in southern Israel, you could hear the sound of explosions, possibly rockets being intercepted, possibly airstrikes in Gaza in the background. We've had barrages of rockets coming from Hezbollah in Lebanon today, and more Israeli airstrikes on Hezbollah targets there. We had a ballistic missile fired over from Yemen, which was intercepted by the Israeli military, but the sirens rang out, and that was just as the big event in Tel Aviv tonight to commemorate October the 7th was due to start, so that was a possible target. So, you know, the war is very much going on in Gaza, and against everyone's fears, it has spread.
And briefly, John, we still await an Israeli response to those Iranian ballistic missile attacks.
Yes, and it is almost inevitably going to come. We expect that probably in the next few nights. The scale of that response will probably determine the direction this conflict takes.
The BBC's John Donison in Jerusalem. Well, Amichai Chikli is the Israeli Minister for Diaspora Affairs and a member of the Knesset for the governing Likud party of the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. When we spoke earlier, I began with the pledge that his government made immediately after the attacks a year ago to destroy Hamas and to rescue the hostages. Would he accept that neither of those have happened so far?
I disagree. I think that Hamas, as a military power, is destroyed, is not functioning. None of his battalions is functioning. There is no chain of command. There is no intelligence, logistics. It's not an army anymore. So therefore, in terms of military capabilities, although they might have a rocket here or there, Hamas is not functioning as a military terror army anymore.
When you say they might have a rocket here or there, they've fired some in the last few hours.
For the past 3 months, there's been almost zero rockets coming from Gaza Strip. So October 7, they saved some in order that they could show as if they are still functioning. But if you are connected to the reality, they're not functioning. Okay, we do have some more work to do. It's not eliminated yet, but it will take time. We will need to have more operations in Gaza, but it won't be a full-scale war as it was in the past year.
If the cost of what's gone on already in Gaza is the loss of nearly 42,000 lives, according to the Hamas-run health ministry, is that a price worth paying, as you see
it? I would call it the Hamas fake ministry, but obviously there are a lot of casualties.
Many of them children.
The casualties are a direct result from Hamas' choice to open war on October 7. I remind you that there was a ceasefire on October 6. Israel did not open this war. So Hamas bears full responsibility for this war and also the methods of the war. When Hamas is hiding in shelters with civilians, in hospitals, so as a result, there are also civilian casualties. But the responsibility is on Hamas and only on Hamas.
Okay, I hear that point. The other point I raised was regarding hostages. And again, going back to what your prime minister said straight after the attacks on October the 7th, we will rescue the hostages. As it stands, around 100 are still being held. And sadly, we don't know whether they are alive or dead. So again, is that not something you have to acknowledge that has not been realized?
I haven't said that we have finished the war, but regarding the hostages, which is a top priority, we have difficulties with the leadership of Hamas to reach a deal to bring the rest of the hostages. I think that as long as Sinwar is the one who is leading the decision-making of Hamas, we won't be able to reach a deal.
You are understandably critical of Hamas's leadership, but those hostage families who want news of their loved ones, they in some cases are critical of Benjamin Netanyahu here.
We live in a democracy and this is legitimate, and there's a variety of opinion within the family of the hostages.
Of course, but some are saying he's not done enough to get a deal here.
We all have one goal, to bring them back home.
There are now other aspects of what is happening in the Middle East. In Lebanon, Hezbollah are still firing rockets. Are you pledging to destroy them too? And if so, at what cost, given that according to the Lebanese authorities, 2,000 people have died, 2,000 civilians in Lebanon?
Of the North, we did not choose to fight Hezbollah on October 8th. The reality could have been different. They choose to wage war. We needed to evacuate our citizens from many of the villages up north, with tens of thousands of people who left their homes. And we now have a mission to bring back the people to their homes. And we will do anything that is required in order to bring them back home.
Even if civilians in Beirut are the price for that.
If you are following the IDF operation, we are asking people to leave the Dahiya and to leave the villages where we are operating in order to prevent civilian casualties. I'm very proud with the results, eliminating Nasrallah, eliminating the top commanders of Hezbollah with a very precise assault, which is directed only, solely, to hit the terrorists themselves and not anyone else.
What of Iran now? We know we'll respond to their ballistic missile attack because Mr. Netanyahu has made that very clear. Is anything off limits when you do?
This is a war, actually, against the state of Israel. And when people say, we don't want the situation to escalate, I don't see where can you escalate from firing 300 ballistic missiles into Israel. And therefore, Iran, just like Hamas and just like Hezbollah, will pay a very high price for their crimes.
Amichai Chikli, Israeli Minister for Diaspora Affairs. And for more analysis on the last year and what might happen next, do download the Conflict podcast. The Chief International Correspondent, Lise Doucette, discusses the war with colleagues from across the region. That's available now on BBC Sounds or wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up, you will hear from a winner of this year's Nobel Prize for Medicine who missed the news of his own victory.
The Nobel Committee tried to contact me by phone, and unfortunately, my phone was off. Then some resourceful person ended up contacting my son, who then called my wife.
Our latest headlines. Israel has carried out further attacks on Hezbollah in Beirut as Israelis mark the anniversary of the Hamas attacks on southern Israel last year. The Lebanese government says more than 400,000 people have now fled to Syria to escape Israeli airstrikes against Hezbollah. Elsewhere, a hurricane heading for Mexico has strengthened to an extremely dangerous Category 5 storm. And a rift in the political party that controls Ethiopia's Tigray province has raised fears that the peace deal that ended the civil war there could unravel. This is Julian Warrica with NewsHour, live from the BBC in London. We take you to Gaza now. Nearly 42,000 people have been killed there in the past year, according to the Hamas-run health ministry, most of them civilians. Israel insists it's been targeting only Hamas militants in their ground and air assault. Trying to tell the story of Gaza is made more difficult by the fact that Israel is not allowing international journalists from media organisations, including the BBC, independent access. But some are still operating there. Among them, freelance journalist Hada Ouda. I spoke to her earlier and also to the BBC's Rushdi Abu Alouf, who was Gaza-based for many years but reluctantly left in November because he was worried about his family's safety. Hada told me first about the current situation in the enclave.
Well, today it's marked the first anniversary of the 7th of October, actually. As a personal opinion, I'm not feeling good. It's a year of displacement, a year of losing my beloved people, a year of suffering, a year of too much famine, too much hunger, too much destruction. It's not the only situation for me. It's also for all of the people of 2 million people here in Gaza who have been displaced in other places. So it's not a good day for us. It's too much pain.
This is a story that you have been trying to tell over the past year as a journalist. How challenging has that been?
Well, it's a year of a challenging, actually. You know, it's like everything, it's destroyed and everything is not becoming normal as usual. A year of... no feeling, no emotions. You cannot cry your who's dying. You cannot say goodbye to people, even from your family, to see or to say the last goodbye for them. A year, my brother with his wife and his daughter is still under the rubble. It's now almost 1 year. I cannot find, like, my father body. He died last January, and I couldn't say goodbye for him. I cannot handle what's going on. It's too much, too much. And it seems like it's going to be like the next year, maybe. It will continue to the next year, or we don't know. So the same, the last year, the next year. So it will be the same situation.
Rushdi, to you and October the 7th a year ago, you were there at the time. What are your memories of that day?
Well, I still remember it as if it was happened yesterday, you know. This year was long, but it was also quick. It started as usual with me like trying to leave the house, taking my two little daughters to school, and suddenly rockets were flying from all over Gaza Strip and explosions, and something unusual is happening. And, you know, I have this warning app that is warning you when there is rockets fired, and the app was almost freezed because of the number of alerts that received very quickly. So I realized something is big, but what went in my mind that day that maybe it's Israel like assassinating like a Hamas leader outside and Hamas is retaliating. Nobody ever expect Hamas to carry out this attack in this scale. And it was like watching a movie when we see Hamas, like, you know, militants breaking through the fence, which I've been close to this fence many, many times during like 20 years of covering the story in the BBC. And we always feel that this is the most secure wall and fence ever built in the history. And to see it very quickly, like, collapsed and Hamas militants inside killing people and taking hostages and back with the Israeli equipment inside, the first few hours were a sense of joy. And people, many people in Gaza were celebrating, and because they believe that Hamas was a reaction to action by Israel for years. So people were celebrating. We have seen them in the street. We filmed them celebrating and dancing and playing fireworks in the morning. But very quickly, they realized that what is coming is really massive, and the retaliation from Israel will be massive. And I received this message this morning by somebody from Gaza. He said, "We enjoy one morning and we suffer 365 days.
That was the BBC's Rushdie Abu Alouf, who was Gaza-based for many years. And we also heard earlier from the freelance journalist Hada Ouda in Deir al-Balah. That's a Palestinian city in the central Gaza Strip. Now, 2 years ago, several million miles into outer space, a NASA probe was deliberately crashed into an asteroid called Dimorphos. Well, now a mission is underway to study the consequences of that crash and whether it succeeded in diverting its orbit around a larger asteroid. A spacecraft designed to visit Dimorphos has successfully blasted off from the United States within the last few hours, and it's due to reach its destination before the end of 2026. The project is run by the European Space Agency, and earlier its Director General, Dr. Joseph Aschbacher, told me more.
About 2 years ago, NASA was sending a satellite to the pair of two asteroids, Didymos and Dimorphos. On one of them, on Dimorphos, they were actually at the end really crashing the satellite onto the surface and to see what impact this will have on an asteroid, of course, with the aim of to study deflection of an asteroid if it would come to planet Earth. So what we are doing, we have launched today, but it takes about 2 years to get to the asteroid, is to measure the impact and see exactly what happened. There will be a lot of debris that has been released through the impact. We do not know exactly how the inner structure has changed. There may be some cracks or some changes of the inner structure, but also the orbit of Dimorphos around Didymos has changed. It was reduced by 33 minutes, meaning that the impact was really severe and has actually changed the orbit duration more than we expected. We assumed some 2 minutes of change and 33 minutes was the result. So there's a lot of questions which we have. We need to answer them. And of course, the purpose is to understand how asteroids are functioning, what they are composed of, and eventually, if ever an asteroid would come closer of a decent size to planet Earth, that we could do something to deflect it or to protect our planet from an impact of an asteroid from outer space.
So presumably, if the orbit of Dimorphos has changed as a result of this initial crash that you were describing, that does give you hope that deflecting an asteroid is possible by this method. Is that right?
Absolutely. And we're pretty sure it is possible. But of course, we have to be very cautious on how this is done and to what extent. Because if you make mistakes and just assume for a moment that this would be close to the planet Earth and such a deflection would not go the right way, could even become worse than what we intended to do. So absolutely, we need to understand on how this works, what the impact is, and how we can eventually deflect an asteroid or even guide it away by launching a spacecraft. And the sheer size of the gravity of a spacecraft, because asteroids are not so large, could give it a gentle nudge to another direction and therefore not come towards our planet Earth. From here to our planet and back is about 22 minutes. So you can imagine that we need to install some pattern recognition software on the Hera spacecraft and therefore to autonomously decide where to fly, what to do, and also which pictures to take. And also if there are maneuvers necessary to avoid any collision, that this is done on the spot. So yes, we have artificial intelligence there on board in order to enable exactly that.
And how big a risk do asteroids pose the Earth at some point in the future?
The size of Dimorphos is roughly 150, 160 meters in diameter. If such an asteroid would hit our planet, this would wipe out a city. And of course, we can already see that with the impact that we can make on such an asteroid, we would be able to deflect one that would come to our planet.
Dr. Joseph Aschbacher, who's the Director General of the European Space Agency.
He owned iconic luxury brands.
Harrods was the ultimate glamorous shop.
The most famous people in the world coming there.
But Mohammed Al-Fayed used his wealth and power to control more than just his business interests.
Mohammed Al-Fayed was like an apex predator.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods, from the BBC. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. A striking phrase emerged from a report today into the state of global water resources. According to the World Meteorological Organization, we have reached peak water. This is based on evidence compiled last year. 2023, incidentally, was the driest year recorded since data was compiled on the subject. That dates back more than 30 years. Sulagna Mishra is a scientific officer at the WMO, and she told me what's meant by peak water.
What peak water means is the threshold of maximum runoff that could come from a glacier due to melting. So what happens is every winter you get the snow up there, it then settles in to become ice, and that then slowly melts down in the summer to give us the water that we're using, often downstream. But once we have more melting than we have recharge, is when the situation becomes more critical and something to worry about.
And that's where we are now, you say?
In many of the cases. So we have observed that the summer mass loss in the recent years shows us that many of the glaciers in Europe, in the Scandinavian area, in northwestern Canada, for example, South Asia and New Zealand have already passed the peak water. But there are still many, for example, Southern Andes, Russian Arctic, Svalbard, these are still in the increasing melting rates. So they have not reached the peak water yet, but they're probably in few years, in few decades. We don't yet know this properly, but they will reach there if the climate change is or the warming up is happening in the same rate as it is now.
Alongside that, 2023 was the driest year on record. So you put that alongside what you've just said about peak water. And what are the wider implications of that?
2023 was the driest year in terms of how much area of the globe was actually drier than normal. This was almost 50% of the globe was dry in 2023. And this was this kind of percentage in the distribution of the dry area was never reached before.
Obviously, so, the figures we're looking at here are looking at 2023. We're coming towards the end of 2024. Are there any signs yet as to whether this trend has continued?
We know that 2024 continued to be a very hot year. It was the record warmest summer registered. We still have to wait for the numbers to be sure about how this has affected the hydrological cycle, what signals we are going to see in the different components of the water cycle. For this, we have to wait for the data to come in. But what we expect to see is probably very similar to what we saw in 2023. Because we are already seeing a lot of significant amount of floods, significant amount of droughts.
And in terms of what we can do about it, clearly not all of this is within our control, but the bits that are, is there more that we can do here?
When we have more data, we can understand at a country level, at a regional level, plus at a global level, what is really happening and how the climate signals are affecting our different components of the water cycle.
Scientific Officer at the World Meteorological Organization, Sulagna Mishra. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Warwicker. So it's exactly a year since the attacks by Hamas on Israel, in which 1,200 people were killed and more than 250 taken hostage. Israel's response against Hamas, which is designated as a terrorist organization by many Western countries, has led to more than 41,000 people being killed in Gaza, most of them civilians, according to the Hamas-run health ministry. Our international editor Jeremy Bowen now looks back at the events that took place 12 months ago and at how this has spiraled into a full-blown crisis in the region.
In Jaffa, it was a glorious evening, but the streets and restaurants were empty. There's a war on. Military helicopters clattered past, heading down the coast towards Gaza. War has reshaped the Middle East. Israel is in direct conflict with Iran, and many Israelis still feel that the horror of the 7th of October, exactly 1 year ago, as if it was yesterday.
We're driving into Kfar Aza now. Got a very strong mental picture of how this was just a couple of days after the attacks. Israeli soldiers were still recovering bodies of some of the dead residents who've been killed by Hamas. Hamas gunmen lying rotting where they fell. And now as I look across the fields, open fields, I can see Gaza, which really is a world all apart.
I'm Jeremy. Jeremy Boyne from the BBC.
Zorschbach.
How many people have come back to here to live?
It's not exactly the right word. It's not came back, but we are here. We are saving the place.
Yeah.
It's more like a house. It's not a home.
So, I mean, as a resident here and having known these people, wherever you look, you must see memories.
Of course. Over there, it's Nadav and his daughter were killed. His wife and three kids were kidnapped.
It's eerie to see things like, you know, someone's boots there. Looks where he kept the gardening stuff and the tools. And, you know, it's where he put it. Yeah, it's like time stood still.
Yes. You have a sentence that he said, "Atikva met achuna." The hope is the last one to die.
Did you think that now, a year later, there'd still be a war, everything would still be upside down?
We are in the same place like we were in October 8th. It's not a memory, it's now. I am still the man who wants the peace, the one who wants a good life.
Kfar Aza and the other border communities that Hamas attacked have become repositories for Israelis of a continuing, very raw national trauma. And what happened here and elsewhere along the border is for Israelis an absolute justification of everything that has happened since then. What you hear often in this country is no other nation could tolerate this being done to them and not answer back. Kfar Aza is very close to Gaza. You can hear the Israeli army's drones. We journalists can look in, but the Israelis don't let us cross over. So we commission trusted Palestinian freelancers to gather pictures and interviews for us. In Gaza, nearly 42,000 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli strikes, mostly civilians. Almost 60% of buildings have been destroyed. In their tent in Al-Mawasi, an area Israel called safe but has bombed at least 18 times, Insaf Awad and her children are reading from the Quran. Insaf and her husband and their son and daughter have survived, but they've been forced to move 15 times and seen so much death.
We were walking on Salah al-Din Street when a car was hit. We saw it burning. On the left, there were people killed. On the right, there were people killed. Even the donkeys were thrown around in the bombing. And we said, that's it, we're done. The next rocket will be for us. The feeling I had at that moment is something any mother would feel. Anyone who owns something precious and is afraid it might slip from their hands at any moment.
Insaf's son, Anas Awad, says his life has turned to sand.
There's no future for Gaza's children. The friends I used to play with have been killed. The mosque where I studied the Quran has been bombed. My school has been bombed. So has the playground. Everything is gone. I want peace. I wish I could return with my friends and play again. I wish we had a house, not a tent.
I'm at Kalandia checkpoint, which is between Jerusalem and the Palestinian town of Ramallah on the West Bank. And here there is huge queues of traffic, loads of Israeli security, a massive concrete wall, watchtowers. It's really a symbol of the failure to resolve this conflict, a conflict that has gone on for more than a century. Now, after the Hamas attacks, Joe Biden did have a plan, which was that Israel allows a Palestinian state. The Saudis then recognize Israel. The Americans do a security deal with the Saudis. The idea was to sort out the region. It didn't get off the ground. Principal reason, Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel and most of his fellow citizens of Israel are against the idea of a Palestinian state. So they're left with this reality, the walls, the checkpoints, the security, the guns. We're just coming through the checkpoint, lots of Israeli soldiers, yeah, and they're going to stop us.
Yeah, everybody.
Hi.
No, I'm asking where did you come from?
Ramallah.
Ramallah?
Yeah.
And nobody shoot you?
No.
You know, it's not automatic.
Huh?
It doesn't always happen.
Trust me, it always happens. I know a little bit more than you.
If you've got a foreign passport, it's easy, but very different for Palestinians. I've come across Jerusalem to what was supposed once to be the Palestinian parliament in an area called Abu Dis. This was supposed to be one of the fruits of the peace process. They built quite a bit of it, but it was abandoned a long time ago. The peace process didn't work. Too many powerful people, Palestinians and Israelis, were against it. I mean, this place is deserted. There are wrecked cars, piles of rubble, the ever-present wall. I mean, it just reeks of hopelessness. And so here there is, well, there are a lot of broken dreams here. Actually, almost forgotten dreams that there could be a better future. Because right now, there is nothing positive to look at in terms of the way that Palestinians might be able to live alongside Israelis and vice versa.
And that was Jeremy Bowen reporting. Well, Hezbollah rocket attacks from southern Lebanon into Israel over the past year have led to the evacuation of many towns close to the border. The Israelis say their military offensive in Lebanon is aimed at stopping those attacks and allowing people to go back to their homes, although the Lebanese authorities say that's been at a huge price, as many as 2,000 civilians killed, they say, with countless more forced to flee their homes. And there have been further attacks on a southern suburb of Beirut today. In Israel, Hezbollah rockets are still reaching areas further south, beyond the areas that have been evacuated. One such place is the city of Carmel, which suffered two direct hits overnight. The city's mayor, Moshe Koninsky, told me about those latest attacks and the damage they've done.
We've been attacked for the last 10 days, nearly every day. We have about two or three alarms and about tens of are, you know, on top of us. Most of them are getting destroyed by our iron dome by the Kippat Barzel. But we have a lot of damages, a few houses, about 20 that got hit by the fragment. Well, thank God nobody got hurt, because they stay during the all attacks in the safe room, in the shelters, and waited 10 minutes until everything ended. And they kept themselves alive.
You mentioned the Iron Dome defense system. Yeah. Do you have confidence in that?
Well, there is no 100%, but yes, it is the most powerful way to keep us alive. And we see the result.
People who have been following this conflict will be aware of the fact that in towns closest to the Lebanese border in Israel, people have had to evacuate. But yours is just that bit further away from the border, is that right?
Yes, we are about 17 kilometers from the border. But, you know, also in the 2006 Lebanon war, we got about 200 missiles that entered and hit houses. It did a lot of damages in the city and in houses. So people here are very strength and they are stubborn. And we believe that the war is a justful war.
I'm interested in what you said about that mindset of people being stubborn. So there isn't an appetite among people to want to try and get out and move somewhere safer.
Look, if there is one that can be evacuated, those are the people in Lebanon, not the people in Carmel. This is their turn to evacuate this the south of Lebanon. And this is the only way to secure the border of Israel.
You'll be aware that clearly as a result of recent events, the Israelis, with the decision that they have taken over attacking Hezbollah targets, the consequences that is having in Lebanon and more widely around Lebanon. Now Hezbollah fired rockets in your direction and have done that on a number of occasions, as you were describing earlier. Despite all of that, you don't want a ceasefire.
Of course we want finally a ceasefire. But first of all, we are not attacking, we are defending. We are defending our lives, we are defending the people that are living for tens or hundreds of years in the north of Israel, and this is their home.
But you know what people who followed the history of this over decades will say. They'll say that's been tried before, and the fact that it's happening again suggests that that approach has not worked.
This is our only country, and we have to defend our country. And people here don't like to go to war, and we don't like disputes. But if a country or a terrorist organization attacks us, so we defending ourselves. This is the only way that we know to keep on our existence here in this wonderful country.
The mayor of Carmiel in northern Israel, Moshe Koninsky. This is Julian Warica with NewsHour Live from the BBC in London. Now, two American scientists are celebrating today. They're joint winners of the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine. Victor Ambros and Gary Ruvkun won the award for their work on what are called microRNAs. They influence how genes, the instructions for life, are controlled inside organisms, including us. And their discoveries help explain how complex life emerged on Earth and how the human body is made up of a wide variety of different tissues. Well, Professor Ambros is a biologist at the University of Massachusetts, and he's been telling me how it felt when he discovered he'd won.
Quite astonished and of course, happy. I was really happy to hear that this was shared with Gary Ruvkun, my good friend, and nothing could be better.
How were you both told? I mean, how is that news passed on to the winners?
In my case, the Nobel Committee tried to contact me by phone, and unfortunately, my phone was off. Then some resourceful person ended up contacting my son, who then called my wife.
Tell us about the work that you and Gary have been doing here.
Well, we discovered a means by which, you know, in animal and plant cells, certain genes regulate the activity of other genes in a way to enable the development of the organism to be, you know, coherent. And the agents of this regulation are a surprisingly short little copy of a surprisingly tiny little gene. And that's why they're called microRNAs. At the time that we found this, it was actually quite surprising to see that such a small bit of the genome could have such a specific and impactful effect on the expression of another part of the genome.
Forgive me if I put this summary to you, which is the way the BBC website has described what you've discovered. Their discoveries, they say, help explain how complex life emerged on Earth and how the human body is made up of a wide variety of different tissues. Does that tell the story?
Yes. What that statement is doing is speaking to how we understand the complexity exhibited by cells in our bodies and the complexity that we observe out in the amongst animals and plants, you know, such that we get a very complex animal such as ourselves. So we believe that the microRNAs represent part of probably a suite of innovations that occurred in the common ancestor of the animals.
And the more someone like you understands what you described as the genetic toolkit, how much does that inform the work that goes on to develop medicines in the future, treatments of particular conditions among humans, most obviously cancers? Does it apply usefully in that kind of area?
Yeah. For example, if you take LET7 as an example, the microRNA that Gary Ruvkun discovered, it's a microRNA that is not expressed in early embryos, but is expressed later in developmental stages when the animal's cells are differentiating. And so when cells differentiate, they need LET7 to emerge. LET7 turns out to be, in fact, a tumor suppressor. You know, you can imagine there could be strategies for trying to couple this knowledge of LET7 as a tumor suppressor to diagnostic or therapeutic purposes. Mm.
Forgive me finally for talking about money, but the pair of you have won a substantial sum of money as a result of your work. Do you apply that now to further research?
My wife and I are minor philanthropists. There are some projects that we've been supporting and we're going to continue to do. So this will certainly add to, you know, our ability to contribute. We support through MIT a program called MEET, which is Middle East Entrepreneurs of Tomorrow, program that brings together Palestinian and Israeli high school students for a three-year program. They work on projects around using coding and entrepreneurship skills that they learn to solve problems that are important in their region.
Professor Victor Ambros, a joint winner of the Nobel Prize for Medicine. Now, we end the program with the words of Yonatan Zeigen, who is the son of the Israeli peace activist Vivian Silver. Vivian, who was 74, was killed by Hamas militants on October the 7th in Kibbutz Beri, which is right next to the Gaza border. Yonatan is in the kibbutz today to visit the cemetery where she's buried and to spend time with other bereaved families. He told me about his mother's work and how determined he's been over the past year to continue it.
She was born and raised in Canada, and she chose to come to Israel in 1974. Together with a group of young idealists, they established a new kibbutz. And she was engaged since the beginning in social justice issues, feminism and coexistence between Jews and Arabs in Israel, and also cross-border work. And she dedicated her life to it. And I think that that's why she became so prominent in the field, because it's not only what she did, but how she did it.
And it's an indication, isn't it? Everything she stood for was so diametrically opposed to what happened a year ago.
I'm not sure I analyze it like that. She fought through her life to try to prevent what happened and what is happening since then. So in that sense, she worked in the context of what we saw, because she knew that if we don't pursue peace, then we'll get war.
She was a peace activist. She dedicated her life to a peaceful coexistence with the Palestinians. She founded organizations to that effect. How much do you then feel you want to carry on with that work as much as you possibly can?
Since October 7th, I felt very strong urge and responsibility to continue the work, to create new types of actions, to create a reality where we don't have to face these kinds of catastrophes anymore.
And how much do you think that kind of work is able to change minds?
I have experienced those kinds of transformational processes that people go through while hearing. You know, if I speak in a room together with another bereaved Palestinian, then I notice that people go through a transformational process. I think there needs to be a dual movement, one on the ground, civil society continue to train the minds and the heart for the possibility of reconciliation, but also we need the political sphere to move.
You would presumably acknowledge that we are such a long way away from what you've just described.
I tell myself that we are on the brink of either being worse off or resolving it. And I contribute whatever I can to pull us in the direction of a resolution. I think that it's not that we don't want it because it's complicated. It's complicated because we don't want it yet. It's a matter of will.
Yonatan Zeigen, determined to continue his mother's work. And that's it for this edition of NewsHour. Thank you for listening and stay tuned to the BBC World Service.
Hi.
He owned iconic luxury brands.
Harrods was the ultimate glamorous shop.
Most famous people in the world coming there.
But Mohammed Al-Fayed used his wealth and power to control more than just his business interests.
Mohammed Al-Fayed was like an apex predator.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods, from the BBC. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.